Johnson will argue for the Pitts. You have 25 minutes, counsel, and then another 5 in rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Justice. Good morning, Justices. This case has profound practical implications, the decision of this court. Century, in its brief, in the introduction, says, and I agree with this, this case presents relatively simple issues, but I say with profound practical implications. The Pittses, and I'm honored and privileged to represent Christina and Clifford Pittses, believe that this court's resolution decision in Vogt versus Schrader decided the equitable considerations that govern the decision here today. That decision, rendered 18 years ago, has provided clear guidance for trial counsel, both on the defense and on the plaintiff's side, as well as subrogated parties, for the resolution of automobile accident cases, which brings us here today. Within this equitable framework, I think the court needs to look at the overall contextual setting, and if I may just address it. Christina Pitts was injured in an automobile accident, as was her right under Wisconsin law, common law. She brought a tort action against the tortfeasor and the tortfeasor's insurer. The tortfeasor happened to be Dorothy Knepel. The tortfeasor's liability carrier was American Family. Consistent with equitable principles that govern this case as articulated by this court in Vogt, the primary responsibility for paying damages lies with the tortfeasor. We proceeded against the tortfeasor. As that litigation pended, counsel for American Family and the tortfeasor decided that it would tender the $100,000 liability limits. Now, this is based on a separate set of equities that aren't at issue here. But as this court is well aware, American Family had a duty to act in good faith to defend and protect its insured, which meant when American Family and its counsel determined that the damages potentially exceeded the limits, they would tender. And there's a whole line of cases that say that. American Family tendered its liability limits. We were in the middle of a lawsuit. Vogt said to the Pittses and said to me and every other plaintiff's counsel, when you are in a lawsuit and you have an offer, you are intending on making an underinsured motorist claim because you believe your damages are in excess of the available coverage or what you can recover, equitable principles require that we contact Century. And we did. On January 3rd, 01. Now, Vogt said, look, if you're going to accept the settlement, and on a side note, our policy has a provision that the Pittses cannot settle with the tortfeasor or their insurer without consent. Now, that provision is implied, and it's consistent with this court's decision in Vogt that created an extra contractual requirement based in equity that said, look, when someone is paying money, and in this case, American Family tendered its limits, if you intend to proceed against Century for underinsured motorist benefits, a separate claim, a claim in contract, not in tort, a claim governed by, and this court's most recent pronouncement is Danner, a first-party relationship. When you have to protect Century, we did that. We told Century under Vogt they had 30 days to either consent or substitute. Now, it took them longer than 30 days, but they ultimately substituted to protect their interest in the lawsuit. Now, as a result of that substitution, there was no release of the tortfeasor. Our policy also requires that we continue to proceed and protect the interests of Century as well as to try to recover as much as we can from the tortfeasor. We subsequently obtained an offer from the tortfeasor for $40,000. Again, this is a settlement coming from a possible responsible party where we would also seek to recover for excess damages from Century. Pursuant to those equitable principles and our policy, we had to tender that offer. That was in June of 2002. Now, Century said we don't have to consent or substitute because our policy doesn't say tortfeasor. It only says tortfeasor's insurer. To adopt Century's reading would reverse vote and turn the law of personal injury lawsuits into a quagmire where nothing is certain. Because I want and I would like to be able to ask Century directly. The question for it as a first party insurer is this. Do you believe the case, Christina Pitts and Clifford Pitts damages, are worth at least $140,000? Because if they are, as an underinsured motorist carrier under Danner, you have an obligation, first party obligation, to immediately pay the $40,000. The Pitts have not been paid the $40,000. The $40,000 that they produced as part of the equitable resolution of this came from the tortfeasor. And yet, Century says, we want to preserve our rights against the trust. Because in the event we have to pay more in underinsured motorist benefits, we want to recover more. Now, but that puts them in a quagmire. Because under Danner, if they believe their evaluation really means that their case is worth $140,000 or more, they have to pay the Pitts $40,000. Because Danner stands for the proposition that the Pitts bought and I buy UIM insurance and you buy UIM insurance to protect ourselves, not the tortfeasor.
But don't they have the right to keep their right of subrogation?
Absolutely.
All right. How do they do that?
And I think the reason we're here is because the trial court confused what substitution meant.
Well, how does Century pay you $140,000 and keep its right to subrogation?
It came in two pieces in this case. American Family put their $100,000 to the court. It's there. Under the trust agreement, the Pitts agreed Century's entitled to the $100,000. They get that. The $40,000 under Vogt versus Schrader, that you have to pay benefits to have a right to subrogation. Every case this court has decided on that, you have to pay out to maintain that right. If they wanted to preserve their rights against the tortfeasor, they needed to substitute the $40,000, and thereby they preserved all their rights against the tortfeasor. The trial court, I believe, that's the basic mistake the trial court meant, because the trial court believed and says he believed that it would preclude.
Okay, so there's a substitution, say, in the lawsuit of Pitts versus the revocable trust, right?
Right.
Then what happens?
In this lawsuit.
I want to know what happens in a lawsuit where there's substitution.
Right.
There was no substitution here.
There was a partial substitution for $100,000.
The $100,000, right.
Correct.
The lawsuit continues, doesn't it?
The lawsuit continued.
So there's no release of the tortfeasor.
Okay.
And what's decided? Damages?
Well, here's the issue in this case. we had to seek declaratory action to invoke our equitable remedies under vote, to have them either consent or substitute, because the court in vote had said, look, an underinsured motorist cannot compel an insured, it's insured, to incur legal fees, expenses to pursue the tortfeasor, and or it cannot prevent or thwart their insured from receiving payment. In this lawsuit...
And you insisted on that.
On
Sentry not coming in and intervening.
That's not... Let me just clarify that, okay? Because this case also presents me individually, and I don't know of any reported decisions, where the UIM insurer, in its first instance, tried to intervene as a defendant. Okay, because there's two interventions here. Initially, in May of 01, Century moved to intervene as a defendant. The way I have read this court's Danner, Ruckel, Cunningham, Garrity, Ryan, plaintiff. Century tried to move in as a defendant. Now, this is also very important because it addresses Century's straw argument about the separate lawsuit. The provision, the contract that governs UIM, had a provision for arbitration, but what's unique about this is with the consent of both parties. Back in May of 2001, Century could have said, look, let's get arbitration, let's decide the UIM, I'll stay the proceedings against the tortfeasor, we'll get the value, and we'll go get all the money then from the tortfeasor. They didn't do that.
Well, they had mediation with Judge Burns.
The question of the mediation, one is I don't know whether it's even a proper subject of the discussion. Regardless, because I didn't object to it because it accounts for some of the delay. The Pitts did try to resolve this legal mess without taking up the court's time.
So there was no arbitration.
And Century could have arbitrated if they would have consented. Instead, they moved to intervene. Now, this is very important because they moved to intervene as a defendant on the side of the tortfeasor. And essentially, our argument to the trial court was now you're moving in as an excess liability carrier. But when Pitts has purchased UIM coverage to protect themselves against calamity, they never dreamt or believed that they were purchasing a defense for a tortfeasor, another lawyer, another set of experts. Okay? The fact that that both under the contract claim and the tort claim, you ultimately have to get to the issue of damages, is very different in how you get there. The contract between the parties said they could have consented to an arbitration, resolve it. They didn't consent. They're entitled to making me prove their case, the contract case, in court. They chose that remedy. I proceeded against the tortfeasor, and I gathered additional $40,000. Now, this is ultimately is to their benefit, in that now we have $140,000 that they're going to get back that acts as a credit.
Counselor, isn't the whole deal here the reason they didn't want to tender the money is if they continue then with the lawsuit and your client doesn't have $140,000 worth of damages, you've gotten more than you've been damaged for, and they don't have anybody to go back after it if the court says, oh, yeah, the damages are $50,000.
And this court in Vogt addressed that exact issue. Vogt was set up as a 30-day time period that allowed the UIM carrier to do exactly what you were asking. You get to assess the strengths of the case. You get to assess the liability. You get to assess the damages, and you get to make a reasonable decision as to whether or not you really have exposure. And they decided not to substitute at 40, the additional 40.
Right.
They substituted at 100. The 100 is still there. You see, their position is inconsistent legally and equitably because Because if it really is in the reserve files that the Pittses are entitled to $140,000, I mean, there is a UIM claim pending. There was a demand went out.
Right, but there wouldn't have been any reason for them not to tender it if they really thought that. I mean, you could argue that vote applies only to an insurance company. You could argue that the contract speaks only to an insurance company. But if they really thought that they have a pocket here that's got $40,000 available, if they really thought your client had $140,000 worth of damage, where is the risk to them?
That's the dilemma that I think they're in. The vote and Dan are both stand for the proposition that the first-party insured is entitled to the money as soon as they can get it, and that the UIM insurer cannot thwart the Pittses' access to that money. If Century believed that the claim was greater than 140 to protect the rights to recover against the tortfeasor, they needed to substitute on the 40. When they didn't, they thwarted the Pittses' right to the $40,000 and the use of that money for 2 years, unreasonably delaying their access to it.
But if you have a trial on damages and your damages come in at $100,000 and they haven't thwarted your, quote, right to anything, right?
But the issue is this right now. Vogt versus Schroeder says this. When the plaintiff proves up its case and puts together a case that it's worth $140,000, we're entitled to that money.
Right.
Now, they get to decide the risk, and that's what Vogt said. You get 30 days to decide the risk. What I throw in there, and I think this is very important, because Danner stands for the proposition that if they really believed the case was worth $140,000, they had to pay the $40,000 now. I mean, it's the routine practice now.
But I'm looking at the other side. What if they don't think it's worth $140,000? They have to pay it anyway?
They didn't have to pay. All they would have to do is consent to the settlement. I take the 40, and we fight over the UIM. They say, we don't owe you anymore. And if they
win, you go to trial and you try to prove up your damages, right?
I'm sorry?
And then you go to trial and you try to prove up your damages that they're greater than $140,000 that you've collected.
And the trial for damages in the contract case is whether or not there's underinsured motorist benefits available.
Yeah.
Then there's a separate issue of what the validity of reducing clause is or what are the setoffs. None of that is before the court.
No, the question is how much are you damaged by, right? If you're going to have a trial and you got $140,000 on the table, then if you can't prove more than $140,000, they're not going to be at risk. But if you prove less and they paid $40,000, you're going to get $40,000 that you couldn't have proved up at trial.
Right. Vogt addressed the issue in terms of who should have the risk.
Okay, but look, you have not proved damages yet. Isn't that right?
Right.
Vogt versus Schroeder looks at this issue. What was the amount tendered? It didn't prove damages. In Vogt, there was a $15,000 liability limit. It was tendered. And ultimately, this court said you have to substitute on the 15 and then proceed. And it protected the UIM insurer's right to proceed to get that $15,000 back. Now, in this case, the Pittses have gone one step further. They not only got the liability limits, they got an additional $40,000. And I want you to look at it this way. If American Family and the trust would have made the offer initially for $140,000, Century agrees they had to stipulate or substitute. They admit that.
$140,000?
Sure. They say they have said, I mean, the logic of their position is if the insurer makes an offer.
Stands in front of the microphone, please. We're recording.
If the insurer makes an offer. And what I'm saying is if the insurer and the tortfeasor initially would have made an offer for $140,000 for a release pursuant to Vogt, we would have shipped it off. And they would have either had to substitute or consent. Now, what happened is it became in two pieces. And because American Family had a pay and walk provision, ultimately the tortfeasor was the one saying the release. You see, in Vogt versus Schroeder, it was a settlement with a release.
Okay. Let's, go ahead, Justice Bradley. Or Justice Prosser, go ahead.
It seems to me, trying to put myself in the position of the insurance company, the two things I really would want to know is how much money does the trust have available and what are the damages? You say that the Vogt decision provides or contemplates basically a 30-day period to make an assessment of what the risks are and the damages and that sort of thing. Is it your position that in order to determine the damages, the only reasonable avenue is to invoke arbitration during that 30-day period?
No, I'm not.
No?
Insurers, and I don't know all the methods at their disposal, but they have access to asset determinations, and it happens on a daily basis. You send out a letter, and you get a letter back from the UIM carrier. They decide to either substitute or consent. It happens routinely on 30 days, and I don't know all what Century has available. The fact is, in this case, due to the mediation and issues that I don't think should necessarily be part of the record, we had a sense of what was in the trust. Now, the Pitts reached an agreement. They got additional money from the tortfeasor, and they said, look, we want to end this litigation, and under Vogt, they either substitute or consent. Century's taken the position that they can do neither and leave the Pittses without the benefit of the money, without the money, and forced to litigate the lawsuit. Vogt very, very clearly said an underinsured motorist cannot compel the lawsuit. If Century believes that there is more money there and the case is greater, they step into our shoes and they can proceed against the tortfeasor. It is unfair and inconsistent with Vogt to deprive the Pittses the benefit of the money, the use of the money, simply because Century says we don't know. They never really know.
Counsel, let's just focus on the $40,000, because that's what this case is about. They can consent or substitute. Now, they don't want to consent because that's going to cut off their rights of subrogation. Is that correct?
Correct.
And the reason they are concerned about this is because I think they're concerned that you're going to come after more, that is, under their underinsured motorists. That's what this is all about.
Right.
I mean, they want to preserve their right to subrogation,
right,
and yet they're on the defensive. They know that you're going to come and ask for more than the $140,000 because you think it's worth more than $140,000,
right,
and they want to preserve that to the extent that you get money from them on their underinsured, they want to be able to go back after the tortfeasor trust. Now,
right,
that's what this case is all about, right?
Right.
Okay. So once you have that procedural down, then the question, I think, is whether you look at the contract, that is the policy, and you look at our precedent, and then you decide if I'm going to start on the precedent. As I understand it, the contract, the issue is the contract, the policy has the insured, the language with regard to an insurance company. Here we don't have that fact situation. So the issue is whether or not silence in the contract controls this case one way or the other, or whether the words of the contract, because there's nothing about our fact situation, whether it controls. That's the issue with regard to the contract. Then you have the issue with regard to the precedent. And the precedent in large part is Vogt that we're talking about. And the issue is whether or not the principles in Vogt, given the difference in fact situation between the insurance company and the insured, apply here. Is that the way this case is framed, or am I missing something?
I believe the argument on the language is a straw man argument because it gets away from the principles, equitable principles, this court has been very clear on.
Well, you've got, but you've got, I mean, this is a case involving an insurance policy, which is a contract, so you've got to look to the language of the contract. Isn't that fair?
That's right. And if you look to the language of the contract, any ambiguity must be construed against Century. In light of Vogt, Vogt has been out there. Now, I want to point out a very important thing that we haven't talked about. When Century substitutes the additional 40, they if they win against the trust, they get the 40,000 back. They have 100,000 that's sitting in the trial court right now that they get back. Do you understand? Right now, Century has not paid a benefit.
But look, let's suppose Century substitutes, just as you said.
Okay.
Now, what's the issue at trial? How much the damages are? Right?
And I think that, yes. And I think this is a very important point.
Well, that's why I'm trying to make it.
It is. Of course.
So, there's damages. Now, the damages could run $120,000, right? I mean, the jury may find $120,000 down. Okay? So, you are going to be out $20,000 because you're only going to pick up $120,000 from American Family and the Trust, right? They're going to be out $140,000 that they paid, and you're not going to get 20 of that back. Now,
right.
Suppose it comes in, the damages come in at $200,000, right? And so suppose the trust can pay that extra $100,000. Then that's the end of that case, right? Are the Pitts bound by that $200,000, or can they now sue you saying their damages is $300,000?
No, the question has always been when there's a right to subrogation. First of all, Century is never entitled to reimbursement until the Pitts are made whole to begin with. But because we have Vogt versus Schrader, we're not into the made whole issue. Vogt decided who has to assume the risk of litigation and the cost. Right now, the Pitts have incurred all the risk and the cost and have put together $140,000. They're deprived of the use of $40,000 and the interest for 2 years. If we go back and try it, and this court doesn't grant us the benefit of that settlement, and we try it and we lose in $120,000, not only are we out another $20,000, we are out the $20,000 that we had settled for from the tortfeasor, because that tortfeasor assessed their liability at greater than the $140,000.
I'm going to start again. Are you willing to release Century if you get $140,000?
No.
No, of course not.
Of course
you
not.
You want that extra, at least up to $250,000, because you think the damages are $250,000 or more, right?
When you buy UIM coverage, you buy first-party protection up to $250,000, less whatever the reducing clauses are. The Pittses took care of themselves. And in this case, we went a step further than in Vogt, and we put together an additional $40,000 from the tortfeasor, and we're being deprived its use.
Well, Mr. Thompson, at least I, and I think some of the other questions, are designed to play out various scenarios to see what happens. And you don't want to play them out.
I will play them out. My light is red. I will answer. I will play it out.
All right. We'll take the scenario where Century substitutes. Now we're going to settle on, we're going to have findings on damages, right?
Okay.
And suppose the damages are $140,000. That's what the jury says. What happens then?
It's going to be the question of this. Is this going to be in the underinsured motorist case or in this torting case?
In this case.
Okay.
In this case. Substitution.
If Century steps into our shoes, tries it against the trust, and the jury says $140,000, Century gets $40,000 from the trust plus the $100,000 that are in, and they're out nothing. They haven't paid anything.
Are you going to sue them under their underinsured motorist coverage?
Correct.
You are. In
correct.
A second lawsuit.
Here. Because they didn't decide to arbitrate. You see, this procedural issue is very important. They had the option under the contract to consent to consent to arbitration for a quick resolution of the underinsured case, the value of the case, and then procedurally they should have stayed this case. They should have stayed this case against the trust, had a timely, quick resolution of the UIM, and then under the duty to cooperate, the Pitts come back in and help them get their money back from the trust. Vote is designed in terms of who incurs that risk. The insurer who paid the premium or the insurer who hasn't paid anything yet.
Seems to me it's not in your interest to have Sentry substitute, because then the Sentry's going to want a low ball damage result.
And that is why, when I said at the outset, when they substitute in as a defendant,
that's right,
I was shocked, because that's what they tried to do. Instead of stepping into the shoes to get as much money they could from the tortfeasor, they came in to defend the tortfeasor. That's inconsistent with the duties and equities in this case.
Okay, Mr. Thompson, are there any other questions?
Thank you very much, Justice.
We have time for rebuttal. Mr. Reed,
representing
Sentry Insurance.
Philip Reed for Sentry. Your Honor, let me get to the heart of this case right away. The critical difference between this case and Vogt versus Schrader is that in the Vogt case, there was a catch-22. The policy language in front of the court in that case created an impasse for what the court referred to as a dilemma. On one hand, it's typical for UIM policies to contain an exhaustion provision, meaning that before you can even proceed with a UIM claim, you have to exhaust the tortfeasor's liability limits. On the other hand, policies also typically contain an exclusion that if you settle that claim without the consent of the UIM carrier, you have no right to any UIM benefits at all. The problem in Vogt was that there was no mechanism to resolve those incongruous provisions in the contract. And so the court had to create the equitable remedy to break that logjam, to do something to allow the claimant to go forward with a UIM claim, to allow it to do something to get the rest of the damages to which the plaintiff might be entitled. And that's why in Vogt the court said that the insured should not have to face this Hobson's choice of, on one hand, having to engage in useless litigation to accomplish the exhaustion of the underlying liability policy, or on the other hand, having to risk coverage altogether by accepting that offer without the consent of the insurance company. That dilemma does not exist in this case. In order to proceed with the UIM case, the Pitts has had to do one of two things, which was, number one, exhaust the liability limit, or number two, present that offer to Sentry and allow Sentry to substitute its funds in place of those offered by American Family. And that's what happened in this case in March 2001. And from that moment on, the Pittses were entitled to proceed to collect whatever other damages they were entitled to collect. They were free to sue Sentry at that moment and proceed to get the compensation, if any, that they're entitled to. Put another way, I think this case is really about when does a court exercise equitable powers. Equity in a contract setting exists to provide relief to a party who's unable to secure an adequate remedy under the terms of a contract. And that's why, in Vogt, the court recognized that something had to be done to secure an adequate remedy or to alter an unacceptable status quo.
And now, Mr. Reed, here you've got the Pitts. They can get another $40,000, or they can go to trial. If they want to take the $40,000, they have to release the tortfeasor. If they don't get Sentry to go along with the $40,000, then that's going to be the end of their lawsuit against Sentry, because they can't release the tortfeasor without releasing Sentry. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So here's their dilemma. They can get $40,000 and stop the running of attorney fees and other expenses, right? If they can get you to go along. So they say to you, they've paid insurance premiums to you for I don't know how many years, just for this awful eventuality. And they say to you, Sentry, you can come in and substitute or not
And if you don't, then under vote, you're going to be liable. Okay. What's the matter with that? Why should they be forced to go through and not? The whole point of our vote is you got a settlement. You want the insured to get their money so they can use it for their injuries. And this is to stimulate the settlement, right? So what's the matter with applying vote?
Your Honor, vote is an appropriate procedure when the tortfeasor's carrier makes an offer, because at that stage you're engaging in the very general question of, is the claim likely to exceed $100,000, and is there something that can be collected from the tortfeasor? Those are the considerations that drive the insurance company's decision. In this situation, we're dealing with a much more fine-tuned analysis. Is it another $10,000 that the claim is worth, another $100,000? And what's the tortfeasor's ability to respond?
Well, that's your business. You're in business to do that. You've got all the resources, not the pits. That's what you're paid for.
My point, Your Honor, is that we're being left to either guess right or guess wrong at that stage. And I'm suggesting that we not be made to guess, that because they can proceed with their UIM claim, since we have substituted, and this is a particular fact here because we do not have a contract which mandates arbitration, that the three parties who are going to need to continue to litigate, that is the trust, the Pitts's, and Century, in one action identify what the damages are and what the responsibilities of the parties for those damages are.
Their position, you know, sounds good to me. All three of you go in, everybody's there, it'll be race judicata, whatever is decided, and you're going to fight about what the damages are, right?
Right.
Okay. Sounds good. Who represents the Pitts?
Mr. Thompson.
I understand that. Who pays for Mr. Thompson?
I believe that in most cases like that, it's a typical contingent fee arrangement that the plaintiff's attorney would have.
Yeah, but one of the reasons they buy insurance is so you're going to pay for their representation.
Well, in a first-party case, when a UIM claim is made, there's no escaping the fact that we are going to have an adversarial relationship with them to some degree. We have it's in the UIM carrier's interest to keep the damages down, or if there's a liability question in the case, to demonstrate that it was the insured's fault that caused the accident and avoid paying damages.
Mr. Reed, before we go much further, I want to take you back a step because I'm not sure I caught the distinction that you were making in the analysis you do in dealing with the tortfeasor versus the tortfeasor's insurance company. Give me that distinction again, because it sounded like you were saying the same thing, the same analysis applied both ways.
When you've got the situation where the policy, as in vote, did not have the consent or substitute procedure, the insured is stuck. They can't settle with the UIM, with the liability carrier, without getting the UIM carrier's permission. If they do that, the exclusion in the policy will void coverage entirely. On the other hand, the court in vote, Justice Heffernan's opinion, identified the fact that court.
I'm not talking about the opinion in vote. I'm talking about the analysis as the insurance company that you make in dealing with either. It sounded like the analysis that you were making is the same regardless of who you were dealing with. So if the analysis is the same, why wouldn't the principles of vote apply in both instances?
Well, obviously we have that procedure in our contract. And I think, first of all, we don't even get to the equitable principles because, as I mentioned, number one, our contract allowed the Pitts's to proceed to get the UIM compensation when we substituted 3.5 years ago. If they had pursued the UIM claim at that point, the case would be entirely done already. Furthermore, and I hope I'm tracking the court's question here, but our contract addresses situations involving settlement with the tortfeasor. So I think it's inappropriate to suggest our contract is simply silent and doesn't address it. And by that I specifically mean we have a provision in our policy which is entitled bodily injury not covered by this insurance. And that prohibits settlement without our consent, no matter whether the offer comes from the insurance company or from the tortfeasor. And so
maybe my question came out more complicated than it was intended to be. It sounded a few moments ago as though you were saying when you were dealing with the tortfeasor's insurance company that you have to analyze how much money is there from the insurance company and whether there's any ability to recover separately against the tortfeasor. And then you took the next step in saying when you were dealing with the tortfeasor, you do the same thing, don't you?
But I think it's a much more refined analysis. When settling with the insurance company or deciding to substitute our funds for the liability carrier's funds, we're making a very general determination. Is the claim worth more than $100,000? We don't have to give thought to whether it's worth $200 or $300 or whatever. And does the tortfeasor have some assets over that liability policy that may make it worth pursuing? But when we get to that next stage of considering substituting for the tortfeasor's company, two things change. First of all, I think we, at that point, the claim can be made. We can all be parties. We can do the discovery that is not available to us when we just have a 30-day notice period where we're not a party. We can take depositions. We can do much more searching discovery than that opportunity allows. And we don't have to guess about the assets available and the ultimate amount of money we owe. And it's not fanciful to suggest that. One of the cases they cite is the Nationwide case out of Kentucky. That's a case where the liability carrier offered money, the UIM carrier substituted. The damages turned out to be about half of what had been paid by the UIM carrier. And that presents the sticky situation then of what do we do? Do we negotiate with the plaintiff at that stage to say, well, if we overpay, we get money back? I can't imagine many plaintiffs are going to be agreeable to that. And we may be, in that situation, pressured to give up rights against the tortfeasor, in essence, by not being able to have information sufficient to identify what it is we can get out of them. And what I'm suggesting is that if you have one action, which is permitted in this case because we don't have mandatory arbitration, that all parties being in the same action can proceed together and we can get a much more exacting definition. Now, the basis for equity is to ultimately place the burden on the wrongdoer. It's also to avoid double payment. If you've got...
Why would you not be protected with the substitution procedure in vote? How are you not protected?
I guess two things. First of all, that assumes we even get the consideration of equitable factors. And I believe our contract addresses the situation, as I mentioned before, and that we don't even get there. But even if we do get there, as I mentioned, you're operating at a very general level when you decide to substitute for the insurance company's money. You're operating at a much more detailed level when you're deciding whether to substitute for the tortfeasor's offer. Because once substitution takes place, we're off to the races. We should be in a position, and I think this was contemplated by vote, that the claim versus the UIM policy proceed, and at that point we'll know what's owed by the UIM carrier and what the right of subrogation is. And I think if it all proceeds in one suit, we're much better able to do that.
Counselor, isn't one of the reasons why there's a difference between substituting for an insurance company and substituting for a tortfeasor is that an insurance company, it doesn't matter whether the damages are bigger or smaller, you can't get any more than what they've got on the table when they offer you policy limits, as they have here. But with a tortfeasor, if the damages are smaller and you've substituted for more, you can't recover all of it back. And so you're kind of stuck with a more exacting definition of what the damages are, aren't you?
Well, that's exactly right. And I guess I would throw in as well, there's a certainty that we can collect back against companies like American Family.
Sure.
There's a relative certainty that they're not going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. We may substitute money for a tortfeasor and find out that when we try to subrogate that, right. That money's no longer there.
Yeah, but look, I'm sorry, go ahead. That's true any time you settle, even with the insurance company. You have to take a calculated judgment of your own whether that tortfeasor has money. Just because they carry insurance, like here, for $100,000 doesn't mean they don't have money, apparently. Right? So even in the vote situation, you make a calculated judgment as to what the tortfeasor's funds are.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. But, again, I come back to the fact that
— So it has to be nuanced, too, if you're smart.
Pardon me?
It has to be nuanced, the same nuances.
Well, and that's why I think it's important to consider the fact that if we're in the litigation, we have the ability to much more readily define what the damages are. We can take a deposition. We can assess the credibility of the claimant. We can get medical records, depose doctors, and do things that
now,
allow us better detail on defining the damage.
The only thing that you really care about, and you don't need to know in this case, whether the injuries are worth $150,776 or $225,347. All the magic number for you is $140,000. Are the injuries here worth more than $140,000? Because if they are, that's all that's on the table, and then you've got exposure under your UIM policy. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. So, you know, one of the things that bothers me is these grand, and I understand this, these grand arguments about the principles of law, but cases turn not only on the principles of law, but on the individual facts. That's one of the things that makes this profession so exciting. Every case is different because the individual facts can reflect how the law is applied.
And it's very clear in vote.
Yeah. I see in these facts, what's the question of whether or not it's over $140,000? In the briefs, it indicates that you've already offered money under your UIM policy. So you must think, unless I got it wrong, I'm looking at the appendix, page 166, and 163 and 164. So you must think that it's worth more than $140,000 if you're already making an offer from your UIM. What am I? I might be missing something, so help me with that.
You know, I'm not sure. What page is it?
So just take a look at page, in the blue appendix, page 163. And this is the July 23rd, 2002 letter from James Fredericks to Mark Thompson. And it indicates at the bottom of page 163 that you've already made an offer of $25,000 out of your UIM money. And then on page 164, and you even floated offering $75,000 to $100,000 out of your UIM money. So what am I missing? I may be reading this wrong, but this is bothering me because if I know there are some questions about, well, maybe it's worth less than $140,000. Well, it looks to me like the record we have before us is an acknowledgement that it's already kicking into the UIM money. And if it's already kicking into the UIM money, then why are you sitting on this $40,000? That's my concern.
My point, I guess, is that we need a final determination to assess. You know, we should not be left to guess what a jury is going to consider the damage award to be.
And that's true. That's true, I submit, in certain cases. That's why I say facts are so important. I mean, as I sit here, I don't know if this case is worth $100, $120. But the only thing, $180. The only thing that for this facts, in this case, is from your point of view, whether it's worth more than $140,000, because that's all that you are going to be subrogated against, the $100,000 already that you've consented and this $40,000 that's in limbo. It seems to me, based on the facts in this case, as I have before me, that you've already acknowledged, now maybe I'm pushing the envelope too much, so stop me on this if I am. But as I read 163, you already acknowledge some exposure. I mean, back at the home office in your reserve under your UIM policy, you've already reserved this for something because you've offered already $25,000 and even floated $75,000 to $100,000. So what am I missing?
One other consideration is what can the tortfeasor contribute?
Well, now that's a separate – what you are going to be able to get out of the tortfeasor, whether this trust is only worth $100,000 or whether they got $1 million in assets, who knows? But that's a whole separate question of what, to the extent that you are going to be able to recoup your subrogation rights, which you're interested in by substituting rather than consenting is preserving your subjugation rights to the extent that you are going to be able to collect them, and you want to properly collect them to the full extent possible, and hopefully this trust is worth $1 million. But it might not be, and you might not be able to. But that's a separate question. That doesn't deal with you and your insured and your obligation to your insured. That deals with your collectability once you have a subrogation right. So based on the facts in this case, what am I missing? I mean, it seems like you've already acknowledged that you're into UIM exposure. Now the question is whether it was 25 or he wanted 150 out of your UIM and you weren't willing to do it.
I see it as one question. One related question at least. What can we get from the trust? We are trying, obviously, to minimize our exposure and to the maximum degree pass on the risk, the burden of paying whatever the appropriate damages are to the tortfeasor. So whether we evaluate the case at $150,000 or $175,000, we have an interest in preserving our right to collect everything.
That's
against
right.
The tortfeasor.
But it seems to me you are meshing your obligations here. You have an obligation to pay to your insured. You've got an insurance contract, and there might be questions as to whether or not how the contract plays out here. But aside from that, because we're just discussing really the boat stuff, I mean, in our question and answer right now and our precedent, I mean, you have an obligation to pay what is due under the contract. You, and understandably so, you know, you want to keep your subrogation rights because you want to try to recoup whatever you can. I mean, you know, you're a good American, too, just like the last in case we had where the utilities were good Americans. You know, they just want truth and honor in the American way. But, you know, you want to, and understandably so, you want your subrogation rights protected. But the question of whether or not you are going to have your subrogation rights protected is different than how much are you going to be able to ultimately get from the tortfeasor in collection. That's a very different question. It's a different analysis, and it has nothing to do, I think, with your obligation under an insurance contract to your insured.
You could frame the issue in this case as follows. Who is going to go without that $40,000 for whatever period of time? The Pitts's or Sentry? First of all, there's nothing in the contract that obligates us to bear that burden. We have a contract, like I said, in the exclusion, it deals with situations where an offer may be made by the tortfeasor. If they settle that kind of offer without our consent, they waive coverage. On the other hand, the consent and substitution procedure that we have only allows that procedure to take place when the offer comes from the liability carrier. So I think, first of all, we don't even get to the equitable consideration. It's simply a matter of contract. Our contract does not permit what it is that they want to do.
Well, let me just ask, this bothers me with regard to the contract, and I understand before you get to the equities vote, you got to talk about what's this contract say. It seems to me your position is your contract provision with regard to consent and substitute only addresses when the payment is made by the insurance company. And that's indeed the way that it appears. But you then take the next step and say, because it is silent, because there's nothing in the contract that deals with when the payment is made by the tortfeasor rather than the insurance company, that we don't have to pay. And I think in the Volt case, the contract is silent also. So, I mean,
the difference. In Volt, there was that logjam. On one hand, the insured could not proceed with the UIM claim at all, except by engaging in what the court described as the useless litigation to get the sum of money that had already been offered. In this case, the Pitts's had already gotten to that point. We substituted, and from that point forward, they are in a position to be able to make a UIM claim.
They got the $100,000, but they're in the same position as to the $40,000 as Vogt was. The only difference is from whom, whether it's the liability company of the tortfeasor or the tortfeasor himself. But here, the Pitts are in exactly the same position, and you're making the big distinction that it's from the tortfeasor rather than the insurance company. And that's hard for me to understand. Did you have a question?
My question would be this. If if I bought $250,000 of UIM coverage and completely legitimately suffered $250,000 in damages, I would want to get that money as quickly as possible and as cheaply as possible. Now, if I'm asking for $250,000 and only suffered maybe $170,000, then intellectually I have to allow you some way to determine what legitimate damages are. What is the way you want to determine legitimate damages without gouging me for attorney's fees to prove what's my injury?
There's a seamless procedure to accomplish that here. In fact, the litigation against the tortfeasor is really entirely unnecessary. If there's a $250,000 claim, as soon as the liability carrier makes its offer and we substitute, the only litigation that's necessary is for the Pitts to sue Century, to leave it to Century to pay whatever amount of damages, whether it's the lower number in your example or the higher number. And either in one action or in a separate action, I think one is preferable, then seek to recoup that from the Pitts's. So in a sense, the entire exercise involving the tortfeasors, a useless exercise, because they had the right as of March 2001 to proceed against us.
Why didn't you invoke arbitration?
I believe Century made the decision that they'd have a better result in litigation. I don't know that the record reflects that, but to try to address your question.
Do you want to force you want to force the victim to sue the insurance company to establish damages, is that right?
There's a lot of discussion in the plaintiff's brief, the petitioner's brief, about the Danner case. They suggest that it's not permissible for an insurance company to require its insured to litigate a UIM claim. I think that's incorrect. I think what Danner stands for is that it's improper to do that when you don't have a reasonable basis to do that. And I don't want to get into what the case is worth or what the medical evidence is, but the fact is we have some medical evidence to support that. It's premature, in a sense, to identify whether we even get to Danner here, because I think to engage in that sort of analysis, you need to know what the end result is. If the end result here is that the damages are $110,000, ipso facto, we won't have acted in bad faith. There's a lot of hyperbole in their brief about an extra set of witnesses, an extra defense lawyer, and that sort of thing. But the fact is, whether they first pursue the tortfeasor and then pursue Century or do it in one fell swoop, there's going to be one set of attorneys for everybody they sue. There'll be only one set of fact witnesses, presumably, to the accident. And in this case, we, in fact, even used the same expert witnesses that the tortfeasor had. I don't think there's anything whatsoever that improper about us being in that case and exercising our right, as any insurance company does in any context, to try to evaluate the case in a fair and reasonable manner and determine what the damages are. Sometimes you're able to settle those cases with your adversary. Sometimes those have to be tried by a finder of fact. But we're not doing anything here that's untoward or that violates Danner or our general obligation to exercise good faith in assessing the nature and value of the claim.
Counselor, if the only claim made under your policy is under first-party coverage rather than under liability, have any obligation to represent the Pittses in that claim?
No, we're adversaries. They are seeking to recover money from us. We're seeking to protect our pocketbook, and we're adversaries. Now, just think about what jury questions would be on a verdict of a case involving all three parties. We also, obviously, in that situation, have an adverse relationship to the tortfeasor. I can't engage in an attorney-client privilege with the tortfeasor. There is no extra set of attorneys for the tortfeasor in that situation. We may have a common interest with the tortfeasor in trying to keep the damages down, but that's simply the nature of this type of claim. And at the end of the day, we are going to be able to hopefully turn around and collect whatever we have paid to the Pittses from the tortfeasor. So I don't think the result we seek in any way diminishes or undermines whatsoever an insurance company's first-party obligations to the insured.
Am I incorrectly reading Appendix 163 and 164? I mean, it's obviously bothering me. As I read this, you've already made the determination that it's going to go somewhere between $25,000 or $75,000 or $100,000 into your UIM policy. That's why I say facts are so important. And that's what bothers me. If you've already made that determination, then how can there be any justification for you saying it's worth less than $140,000? So tell me if I'm not reading this correctly, because that's important.
As I read that, there is an offer of $25,000.
From an insurance company. From Century under your UIM policy, and that it then goes on to say, and that I recall at one hearing this year floating other numbers, and those numbers, to Mr. Thompson, were $75,000 or $100,000 out of Century's UIM policy to settle this case. So, I mean, it just seems to me, if you think it's worth less than $140,000, you're not offering up, your company isn't offering up to $100,000 on your UIM policy. That's what makes me, it looks like you're, and I don't mean this, I need you to address it. I don't mean it personally. It looks like you're talking out of both sides of your mouth, saying it might be worth $110,000, so we don't want to pay. And I say to you, in some cases, that might be true, but not in this case, because you've already offered $75,000 to $100,000 over the $140,000.
I guess I don't read that letter as making that offer.
Just read it as making the 25 offer then, or tell me how you
read it. And there may be all sorts of reasons. One counsel will try to explore with an adversary what the number is. I don't know that that considered relinquishing rights to subrogation. And as I read it, it was making a $25,000 offer. There may be plenty of reasons, including to avoid all the litigation that we've subsequently been through in the years that have passed since that letter was made. Now, as I mentioned, I think we don't even get to the equitable considerations here because our contract addresses this situation, and the remedy provided in vote was to break the logjam to allow the insured to pursue more damages. But even if the court were to consider the equitable considerations here, I think they do not favor Pitts, but rather favor Century. One is there's been, behind the issues here, something not before the court is the reducing clause issue. We have a reducing clause. There's been no declaratory judgment or other action taken to try to invalidate that. And if that reducing clause is upheld, the maximum recovery that there'll ever be here is $250,000. As the Badger Mutual case reflects, that would be the sum of money, the entire pool of money from which the Pittses could recover. And if that's true, then you need not even pursue the UIM carrier. I see my red light is on.
Just finish your sentence, please.
You need not even pursue the trust. You can simply collect whatever may be owing from Century and allow Century either in the same or a different action.
No, but that's the problem. He's got $40,000 right in his grasp. It's a sure thing. Just like in vote. 15 was sure. The way this is set up by Century, you are saying to them, you can't take it because you are then risking the other 110 from Century. And vote is saying you should not put the insured in that position. So to do what you want, you'd expect the Pitts to walk away from $40,000. Isn't that right? And continue litigation.
Right.
Okay. I have another question. Under your policy, do you have a right to do medical exams on the Pitts, on Ms. Pitts?
I quite honestly can't remember. Obviously, the policy is part of the record, and if that language is in there, it will be.
Because I'm wondering, and you talk about all the difficulty of doing discovery, et cetera. Well, some of it may already be in the court files. Others of it might not be in the court file. And I would suspect, although I'll check the policy, that you'd have a right to do an exam on your client.
Your Honor, may I just make one last comment in response to your question before that? Here's the point I want to make. If the choice is to consent or substitute, by consenting we are possibly releasing a tortfeasor who may have more funds to respond to us. By substituting, we may be overpaying.
That's right.
And I think that the problem with that choice is we're left to guess. If it proceeds in one action or proceeds with the UIM claim first and then an action where we can try to recoup, we're not making a guess. We shouldn't be made to guess. We should be able to use exactitude to get it right in the first place.
And then the issue, more broadly stated, which is not what you're going to like, is who should bear the risk, you or the Pitts?
I think that's fair, and my response would be the contract does not require us to bear that burden.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Mr. Thompson, you've got a few moments in rebuttal.
This court said in vote, a plaintiff should not be required to sue for what is being offered and thus incur larger fees and expenses just to accommodate an underinsurance company's desire to protect its subrogation rights. An underinsurance company may not thwart the right of its own insured to receive some payment, either the amount of the insured's underinsurance claim or the amount offered in settlement. If this court doesn't reverse, I believe implicitly you are overruling vote. And it means that a plaintiff that aggressively pursues the tortfeasor and obtains an amount greater than the liability insurance can never accept that settlement. And it has to go to their own insurance company, their underinsured motorist carrier, and say, what do I do with the money? And they can unilaterally, arbitrarily say, sue the tortfeasor. I don't think that's what first-party insurance is about, and I don't think that's what equity is about. And also, it confuses to link it to the seamless lawsuit. Absolutely distorts the contract claim and the tort claim and subrogation principles. Because Century and the Pitts should stand united as plaintiff and voluntary plaintiff against the tortfeasor to maximize the result.
Well, but they're not. They're adversaries to you because they want you to recover as little damage as they can get away with, because they want to limit their liability, and that's fair.
But not in this lawsuit. In this lawsuit, they are an involuntary plaintiff lined up with the Pitts, and we set declaratory action saying, if you really think the case is worth more than 140, if you want to protect your rights, substitute on the 40, protect your rights. Okay?
Protect their rights.
I think this is very important, because what they originally tried to do was come in and act as an excess carrier for the tortfeasor. They file a deck action saying, sue us. And the trial court said, you can't do that. They never appeal that, and that is not part of this case. In this case, they are lined up, and we provided the mechanism for them to maximize their recovery and reduce their risk. See, to date, Century hasn't paid anything that they couldn't already recover. There's $100,000 in the trial court that they could get. They haven't paid anything. The Pittses have been waiting for $40,000 and lost the use of the money, incurred fees, expenses to stand before you today. I don't want to say it's not a pleasure, because I like being here. I don't get here often. But they're under vote, under banner. This court has said the Pittses are entitled to the 40 and the loss of the use of the money. And as to the risk, Century has far greater resources than the Pittses to evaluate those risks. And it seems to me it's just ironic. If this court is not to reverse, it will mean that vote is gone. It will mean that every UIM carrier will seek to intervene as a third-party defendant in liability coverage and seek to limit your recovery against the tortfeasor. I think that we're turning the world upside down, and we don't want to do that. We don't want to do it. The reality is that when you have a contract claim and a tort claim and the damages, sometimes you have to address them in two different forms. Now, they chose the other lawsuit. They could have consented to arbitration. They didn't. That's their right. But they can't come in here now and argue because we chose another lawsuit, we're entitled to one seamless lawsuit. Their contract doesn't say they're entitled to one lawsuit.
Well, isn't one lawsuit a good idea? Instead of two lawsuits, two conflicting jury verdicts, maybe.
I would not object, and I said this earlier before they were dismissed as a defendant. I would not defend with Century joining with me in beating up the tortfeasor and then living with those damages. And if we can't recover from the tortfeasor, we get it from the uninsured. They don't want to assume that risk because they don't want to line up with us. Now, that's their right, too. But the point is, they can only oppose us in the contract claim. To assert a right to subrogation means they have to stand in our shoes and try to get the maximum from the tortfeasor. It would be really ironical for us to be able to put an additional $40,000 on the table from the tortfeasor, and this court say we can't accept it, but we have to go up to the carrier. And what happens to the tortfeasor's money? I mean, it just turns the world upside down.
So your position is they're adversarial to you on the contract claim, but not adversarial to you against the tortfeasor, and that's where they want to be. And they view themselves as totally adversarial to you.
Absolutely. And that to get to that position, you have to throw out subrogation as a principle. Thank you very much.
Counsel, thank you, Mr. Reed. Thank you, Mr. Thompson, for your interesting arguments on underinsured motorist claim. As you know, we've had any number of underinsured motorist coverage issues, and this is yet a different one. Thank you. The hearing on 02-3394 Pitts versus Revocable Trust is ended. The court will be in session at 1:30 for its last case of the day. We are in recess for lunch. Justice Prosser will be out momentarily to talk with you.